Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
You know, this movie is called The Prestige.
It is.
But I think it should be called The Greatest Showman.
Who is The Greatest Showman?
I don't know. Which one?
Hugh Jackman is kind of like in the same zone where he's the showman. He's the man of presentation.
Oh, absolutely.
But
no, this
Bale has the talent.
This is them playing themselves in like the best of ways. It's really great. Like Hugh Jackman just decided to, you know, like take a break from his like 7-year Greatest Showman, you know, production and then just came onto this, did a little routine.
Although I would say IRL, who was the one that pretended to have an American accent for the entirety of the Batman Begins press tour? That's all I'm saying.
Wait, did Bale do that?
Yeah, didn't he?
I don't know.
That's amazing if he did, though.
I feel like he did.
Wow, good for him.
Because I remember that was like a big contributor to the reason every time he pops up on an award show, people are like, oh shit, he's British.
He knows an accent?
Whoa, because like he commits to the bit.
Oh, you know about
isn't
committing
he? He's technically
bit.
Welsh, right?
I feel like we have to get that right.
Yes.
It's very specific. Yeah, definitely.
I can't tell the difference.
I don't know. I don't either.
And Jackman's an Aussie, which I also always forget.
But like, this is like happens with every Australian actor, though. Like every time they're in a movie, like Nicole Kidman, I'll watch a Nicole Kidman movie, then I'll just do like YouTube Nicole Kidman interview just to like try to hear the accent, you know? But I mean, like, she's never really that good at it.
I know. We've talked about this before, but Angie, do you have like a biggest like accent shock actor? Because I didn't realize Toni Collette was Australian until a year ago, and it freaked me out, and now I like can't unhear it. It's very odd.
No, definitely Toni Collette. I was gonna say Don Cheadle, but Don Cheadle actually is American.
Okay,
right, he just like has, but he has the crazy British accent in Ocean's Eleven
accent.
My mind was just about to be blown. I was like, whoa.
He's been doing it this whole time. No, I'm very bad. I feel like I'm kind of bad at catching accents. I was just about this, but I also think it's very funny when I feel like I should preface. I also watched The Illusionist last night.
You did? Okay, that's I'm so glad you did because I wanted to discuss, but this is great.
I had never seen it. Honestly, if you described that movie to me, I would be like, that does not exist. That's not real. That one's supposed to be, I forgot that there was like a whole like magician fight in 2006, right?
Mm-hmm.
Totally different movie, but that movie's set in Vienna, but everyone's kind of doing this British accent. None of the actors are British, but like every once in a while, you feel like they just remembered that they're in Vienna, so it's like slightly German.
Yeah.
Except for Jessica Biel, who's just like a mess all around, and I'm like, who thought in any way Jessica Biel could like pull off Europe
anything
right. anywhere?
Right.
I know.
Right. Well, that's like when Scarlet Witch. I feel like her accent, like she'll occasionally have a pop of it, like you're
the
like, oh right, you're Sokovian, you're not just like an American. Okay, cool.
Oh yeah, yeah. Right.
Or like like with Scarlett Johansson, she's you know
Black Widow.
It's true, right, but I'm gonna say she's probably not the best at accents.
I don't think she's that bad at the accent in this movie.
Really?
I was waiting. I don't know, but maybe I also am a little accent like blind, Ange, and same as you. Because I'm like, I don't know, they sound fine.
I was a little lenient
on everyone in this movie only because I had just watched The Illusionist and everyone was
like stone cold masterpiece.
Did you watch The Illusionist before Prestige?
I did. I didn't want to be because I was like, I have a feeling this one's worse. And I'm like, I didn't want to like fall asleep. So and then I'm like, maybe I'll like it better. And it did kind of work that way where I was just like forced to reckon with the fact that Christopher Nolan is, in fact, a good director. Like, as annoying as he is, I was like, oh, there's like such clear differences in like what makes a compelling story. And then like what is bad.
Brown
sludge, sort of.
I mean, that's the magic in movies should be like fundamentally so boring. So it is like kind of like a magic trick in and of itself when you watch a movie about magic and you're like, okay.
Are we talking like real magic or like this magic? Or are we talking like Harry Potter magic?
No, I'm talking like sleight of hand, magic. Because the whole idea is that it's supposed to fool you in front of your eyes and you're watching it on a screen. So like they can do whatever they want.
You
want to
be fooled.
You do.
Whereas, both of them kind of The Illusionist ends with like a similar like, oh, this is what it was the whole time, but there's not enough like proper like build up.
No,
so instead the camera just swivels around Paul Giamatti while he looks up at the sky and he's like realizing like, oh, it was this the whole time, and it's all just coming to him, and he's laughing to himself like a madman in this train station. Like no one has dropped any hints. He's just like suddenly all the pieces are together. Whereas, like, in The Prestige, they're, like, layered throughout. And also, you have one character kind of directly saying it to another. And you do kind of have the, like, man going, that's what it was the whole time. But Hugh Jackman sells it. And Paul Giamatti does not have a lot to work with. Poor Giamatti.
You have, like, Michael Caine being like, this is what the movie's going to be about the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a bloody double.
It's his brother, I swear to God.
Jordan was practicing Michael Caine impressions for 15 minutes before.
Not practicing. It's like once you do it, it's impossible not to like keep doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the only thing from The Illusionist that I like wish carried over to The Prestige would be like Edward Norton. Like I would love to see him in this movie as like a Bowie, just like completely unhinged in the middle of the woods doing nothing.
Oh, God.
Because I feel like, I don't know, every performance by him, it just feels like he's playing himself.
Edward Norton?
Yeah.
He thinks he's a lot handsomer than he is in that movie. It's like, and he's also like, I don't know.
Is he handsome?
What the hairdresser did? No, but like he acts, there's this like air about him as if like, I don't know.
It's
and
inflated,
also like the shoe polish in his hair. I don't think I've ever really noticed how like drastic. I was like, he should have light brown hair. This is not a good look for him. But it looks like the stylist just put straight shoe polish in his beard and his hair. And he looks like a magician in that you're like, this man sucks. But like he'll just be on stage.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like there's that meme going around, like there's three men in a room and like who do you feel safe with, and it's like never Ed Norton, especially then also never magicians.
No, I think that's the overall lesson of both of these movies is like don't date magicians.
Absolutely not.
Get the fuck out of Dodge.
Anywho. Who are you?
Let's back up a little bit, introduce ourselves. Hello, I'm Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson.
And we are joined today by the lovely Ange Ferragudo, formerly of the Blank Check podcast, but the most important credential of all, fellow Emerson College alumni.
Listen, degrees gotta work for something. So it got me on a podcast. Like, it was all worth it, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
There's
will it get you a job? Probably.
Maybe
not.
I don't know.
Probably not. There's no greater credential than the rank of Emerson alum.
Right, right.
As we know, as Emerson likes to tell
us. I wonder
us.
How they're going to adapt, you know, as Facebook slowly dies. Is just the mafia going to like eventually just be killed off? Like,
I don't know. Maybe it'll transplant onto, what's that weird new social media that just popped up?
Hive?
Clubhouse?
Oh.
There's two. They're competing. Oh, boy. So,
really?
God, I can't. I feel like if Twitter and Instagram and Facebook all die, like, we'll be free. I don't need to join a new social
just
media.
Just free us, finally.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we'll be done for good.
We can escape. Anyway, Ange, we are so delighted to have you here today to talk about this wild...
The Prestige.
...fucking movie.
The Prestige.
The Prestige.
The Prestige. Wait, I need to get God. What is it's the first? The first act.
It's wait.
Oh,
I wrote it down.
The pledge, the turn, and then the prestige.
The pledge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I feel like when he's giving a eulogy, like imagine just Michael Caine reading
Your eulogy.
Yeah, your eulogy. Like that's probably the greatest thing.
Honestly, he seems like a really baller dude. He like owns up to being in shitty movies for the paycheck. He like shows up and kills it no matter what. Like he's a good one scener.
The best part of the Muppet, you know, Christmas Carol.
An awards worthy performance.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. He's great. I mean, he has to ground this movie. It's very, I like that Nolan seems to have the wherewithal to be like, we need someone to come in with like the gravitas and like a guiding hand to like tell the audience what the fuck is going on. Or they're not going to be able to parse it out. I don't know. You know, that's humility right there. And it ends up working. So
I agree.
I feel like I'm going to defend this movie a lot, even though I don't actually love this movie very much, but it is like a very like well crafted and constructed movie. So I feel like I'm going to end up being like, yeah, I mean, what can I say? I can't really argue against it. But at the end of the day,
It's okay. I like it, but I don't love it.
How do you feel? Like, what's your relationship with this movie? Have you seen it before or no? Or
I had, yeah. So I feel like The Prestige was just like a movie my guy friends in high school were like super into. And I was just like, yeah, I'm sure it's fine. And then like they finally made me watch it. And I was like, oh, that was really good. And I haven't seen it. I maybe watched it a few years ago, but I really haven't seen it in years. And I've remembered the Hugh Jackman Prestige, but I did not remember. It wasn't until it started that it like all hit me what Christian Bale's was. And I had completely forgotten about like the timelines being like all over the place.
A disaster, yeah.
Which is like, I was just like, where are they? But I'm like, oh, we eventually figured it out. I was like watching with my friends, my roommates. But I feel the same way about Christopher Nolan, particularly this, that I do about like Quentin Tarantino, where I think listening to him talk for like 30 minutes would be like insufferable.
Yes.
But like the man can edit a movie. The man can like piece the movie together. He writes compelling characters. Does he always fridge women and they have like no personality traits? Sure. But
dead wife.
Dude, movie has two dead wives for the price of one.
I mean, maybe that's the bisexual angle on this, is that they're just like, you can have two dead wives and two alive men.
I hate that. I mean, I also saw this movie, I feel like, for the first time in college. It got sick of people telling me to watch it. And I was like, sure, that was good. I liked it much better this time on rewatch. I think because I knew what was going on going in and I was like, okay, great. I think it does. I mean, some of Nolan's movies, I think you can watch totally cold and be like, okay, this is great. I totally get it. And then it just improves. More on second watch, but for this one I feel like I needed to know what was coming to like appreciate the construction of it.
Well, I mean, he like opens telling you, like, you see the ending of the movie and he's just like, it's gonna be a couple hats on a hats, you know.
hats on hats. A lot of Hugh Jackman hats. Stacked up on top of each other.
Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. I like a movie where when you watch it again, you can like look for the clues, like how Christian Bale is, you know.
So clearly with Christian Bale.
Are you watching closely?
Yeah. He says it about 40 times. And I'm like, damn, how did I miss that?
I am watching closely.
I had it spoiled before. I don't know.
Oh,
like,
really?
First time I watched, I think I probably knew the Bale thing, but I 100% knew about Jackman's thing. So going into it, it was just like, so he's going to like kill himself, right? And like, I just kept waiting for like the clone reveal. So then when it happens in like the final 3 minutes, you're just like, ah. So it was like a very weird first watch. But upon like this, as you were saying, I think this was like my third watch because I watched it late last year as well. But you pick up on those small things, which like kind of love. It's like, it is like that weird thing with like Nolan, like, frustrating, but you also like kind of have to respect it that, you know, he's like our most successful probably like modern filmmaker, but
in terms of like the guy who's able to make like originals every time,
right,
aside from the Batman trilogy, and like rake in that kind of cash,
right?
I think the Tarantino
or Tenant
comparative so well. Is like really good though, because it's the same thing where he is the one that's like actually making like super originals. I feel like if you want to stretch back further, like, I don't know, does Scorsese rake it in the way that Nolan's raking it in?
Because Nolan is just such a popular, I don't know, I feel like he's so popular,
super populist,
and I don't know. There was like a quote that someone was like, he's like an art house auteur with like blockbuster sensibilities or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know.
He's moving into more auteur territory though with Tenet. I feel like the critical consensus was fine, but the audience consensus was like, what the fuck is this?
Have you seen Tenet?
I actually still haven't.
I haven't
like,
either.
I just have to, You're I just free. Don't have like the patience for Chris Nolan in quarantine. Night was fun. But like the only other, I will say pretty early on in quarantine, I will say maybe the best day I had in quarantine was very stressed out. And I may have eaten too much of something that was maybe stronger than I anticipated it was. and I did not know what to do with myself. So I decided to put on Inception and I laughed the whole time. It was fucking hilarious.
So it's comedy.
It is, because it's very fun to just watch men take themselves too seriously. Yes. So I feel like that would maybe also work for this movie.
Oh my god!
I was just looking at Leo, being like, "What is he doing?
Caring too much about his dead wife.
Yeah, another fridged wife. But that's also another movie that you're like, I remember loving it so much. Or like, it's a very satisfying term. But then when you watch it again, you're like, these men are doing too much.
Like, oh my God, it's far too... It's like the same thing as this movie where it's just like, Chris Nolan's like, I'm going to make a movie about filmmaking. There was this book that I was skimming through where he just has a quote where he's like, all of my movies are about storytelling and like the making of stories. And it's like... Yeah, and so like everything falls into like the same framework where, I mean, if you want to like, we'll get further along, but like where Jackman is just like under, you know, the stage, like taking the bow, where you have like the director sort of tied to him, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But right. In terms of Inception, important question, do you ship Arthur and Eames?
I mean,
yeah. It's very funny though, looking back, because he kisses Elliot Page. Yes, yeah. Elliot. And I'm like, so it technically does have like a gay canon kiss in movies now.
Hey, that's kind of fun.
That's so great. Yes. No. But, my God.
When you watch, that's like, I think that's also a good summary of Chris Nolan, is that like you see the character of Ariadne and you're like, that person wants to kiss Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And you're like, where in that is there like any sexual tension? Tom Hardy walks in the room and you're like, whoa.
We gotta separate these two boys, like they're gonna do something.
Yeah. I mean, like, Nolan does sort of have this kind of like gay shipping fandom that ends up following his movies. There is so much now like protagonist and Neil shit like all over the internet from Tenet, when they're like, oh, we love them, we ship them so hard, and like he just he can't escape it.
It's the thing of like, he, let's just say it, doesn't have a lot of female leads in his movies. And so like the men that are left, there's just like this like weird innate homoeroticism to them, because it's just like they're so into like what they're doing and they're so obsessed. And so like the people that they're obsessed with are like the other men.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like, especially this movie is literally just like two men trying to like persuade the other to like fall in love with them and like their bit.
They read each other's diaries. Like, addressed to each other.
It's so intimate.
Yeah, it's extremely intimate. The one tweet I remember coming out when, like, I can't credit them, I can't remember, but when Tenet came out, is just like, Chris Nolan is now, like, he's so heterosexual and is so, like, barely involves women that he's veered into homosexual territory. Like, he only has like two men who are best friends and share everything with each other, or they hate each other. Either way, they only have eyes for each other, which is, you know, super straight.
Absolutely. It's like the whole 80s thing, like 80s action movies, they were so like raw masculine that it's just like, oh, so like they're like getting it on, right? And now that's just Nolan.
I mean, I think that like his obsession with obsession and like these characters that are so like committed and all consumed by the object of, you know, I mean, in this case, like, just jealous, is it, I mean, in the result, it ends up being so all-consuming and so intimate that, like, you can't not see the homoeroticism. I feel like this one, this movie, like, and the reason that we wanted to kick off probably a series of Nolans.
Oh my God,
eventually, with this one, is that, like, I mean, literally Christian Bale decides to live a half-life for his, like, whole-ass wife and child just to pull the wool over Hugh Jackman's eyes for, like, a couple more years.
Right.
Like, that's absurd.
Like, you're
going to
cut your own fingers off instead of just, like, giving up and being like, okay, fine, you have a good, like, routine. Okay, cool.
Commitment to the bit.
They're pranking each other, and, like, they could just, like, you know, kiss and it would be over with.
There's some good, I sort of like that everyone else in the movie kind of has their number for how much they're obsessed with each other, and whether you want to take that from just like a like cold career standpoint or from like a little bit more of an intimate romantic standpoint, like everyone in the movie is basically reading them being like, you're performing for an audience of one, you two deserve each other, you just, you need to know how he does it, you can't give it up, like obsession is a young man's game. All of these just super hot. They know. Everyone knows.
It's also like, magic's like all about secrets. It's like, the thing is like, never give up your secret, blah, blah. And I mean, like, I don't know how you want to view it, but you could kind of view that through like a queer lens of like, never give up like the secret that like you're gay or however you want it to be. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to do that, there is like that angle by which you could read it. And I mean, even further, it's like the transported man is like a magic trick, like in a closet. So it's
they
like,
do, yeah.
I like that.
I don't
that.
Know.
I mean, on the pod, we usually, I actually really like that because we try to skew more towards queer theory and less towards like, oh, they're gay. That's so crazy. Right. So I think it is interesting to look at like the framework of magic and magicians. The whole time I was watching this, I was thinking like, okay, it's a magic trick. It's about hiding who you are. It's about like putting on an act so that people don't guess your real secret.
They're performers.
Yes.
Yeah.
they're illusionists.
Yeah.
The Illusionist, 2006. Yeah,
they're always hiding something. The Illusionist. Oh my God.
It's like that thing you were saying, though, like as we might do like a whole Nolan thing, because if you just look at The Dark Knight, the whole movie is so dark and gritty, and then you have like one flamboyant character who comes into town and just like his whole world is upended and he just becomes obsessed with this one man. It's like, oh my God.
It's the same obsession thing. Like obsession is, I think, like inherently like very intimate and sort of romantic, which is why there are a lot of movies that like take the obsession and make it like textually homosexual, and it ends up, I don't know, I mean, it's kind of fun, but it also is not great representation. But like when it is subtextual, I do think that it lends itself very easily to a queer read because you're all consumed with this person. They're all you think about. It's basically like having a crush.
Oh yeah.
No, like when are you ever like that obsessed with like knowing someone? I wrote every time someone said like an explicitly like that's really gay line. Yeah. I wrote it down. When they reveal a trick, once you know it's actually very obvious. But like I think the first one that jumped out to me, is Angier's writing in his journal. He's like, I'm obsessed over his secrets and knowing his mind. And I'm like, that's how I feel about my exes and people I just started dating. Mm-hmm. And I'm like going through their whole shit and being like, what do they think about me? How do they feel about me? And like all this other stuff. And they're it's another fellow magician and I just want to know his tricks. And you're like, okay.
Know him deeply and personally.
Tricks, that's the only thing you want to know, sure.
I mean, the absolute dedication to, like you said, and writing each other diaries for like over the course of 10 years in code that only the other person can decode. Right.
And both of them have the reveal at the end being like, actually, this whole thing was just for you. And it's like meant to be like, haha, I got you. But it's like, really, it's like, I'm so obsessed with you that I like gone girled this, that I like prepped this whole notebook. Mm-hmm. One point Hugh Jackman even says like he catches him like kissing, he sees Christian Bale like kissing Sarah in the street, and there's just like this huge jealousy that like rises up in him, and he says like, happiness that should have been mine. It's like, which one are you talking about? You I don't know.
Did not even realize, like I know the exact moment that you're talking about, but just didn't even it's again like another thing is like there's so much going on in this movie between these two boys.
It's clearly so accidental, but that's why it's hilarious and super fun. I mean, even poor Piper Perabo deserves better than, I don't know, 2.5 minutes of screen time.
That's
banging against glass. Yeah. Just like with no words coming out. And I think it's just like a good summary for all women in Christopher Nolan's movie.
Instead all of pain, fridging, they're no like, vocals. What is, it's, it's like a tank. So we should like tanking them,
tanking
right?
Them.
Yeah,
basically. But I mean, she and Bale are the ones that kind of like co-conspirated to tie that knot in the first place. So Jackman being all up in arms about the fact that his wife is dead, like it's really not Bale's fault. Are trying to justify your actions here. It's not really his fault.
Are you team Bale or team Jackman in
this? Team neither of them.
team no men.
They suck.
Honestly, team Rebecca Hall, if we're being real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Rebecca Hall gets, like, so fucked over in this. I, like, unfortunately, like, lean towards Bale only because, like, the first... Because, like, it's not necessarily, like, only Christian Bale's fault, right? Because she even said, like, she's like, I can do that knot. And they both have this kind of, like, moment of understanding of, like, all right, we're going to do the tougher knot tonight. Yeah. Which, like, first of all, bad move. Maybe try it in rehearsals first, but whatever. But, like, the fact that... But then Hugh Jackman obsesses over that and then uses that to justify, like, shooting his hand. And then from there, they both escalate. And then it becomes a prank war.
Spy versus spy, basically, right?
But right. But in terms of like the most demented, like obviously Hugh Jackman eventually gets his hands dirty, but like I will say though, Christian Bale does. I side with him in terms of like I kind of appreciate the underdog. Like you can tell he doesn't come from money, and Hugh Jackman's family did, and things like that. But Christian Bale also just reminds me of like an improviser who's just like, I have to stay dedicated to the bit. You don't understand. I'm so dedicated to the bit, Sarah, that I am going to gaslight you your entire life and like this whole relationship.
You're gonna kill like, yourself because of how bad I am to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. My whole apartment just like cracked up laughing. Like again, I had seen it before, but I had fully forgotten about the like secrets are my life, Sarah. Just like imagine justifying that in a fight. We're like, can you please just be honest with me? And you're like, secrets are my life. Just like go fuck yourself.
Sorry. Yeah.
Like, that's the thing is like the fact that she also puts up with him just where she like repeatedly is like, you're like the one who loves me today. You're the one who doesn't love me today.
Yeah.
And just doesn't dump him like immediately is so fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
There was this quote in this, like this Nolan book, that said that Rebecca Hall was the quote, the first woman in a Nolan film with love and affections, who is not herself an object of desire or dread. And I feel like that says something too, that it's, she's not like a lead or anything, but it's also, she's the first woman.
She's
like, who's not just an object.
Yeah. I mean, she technically is like a character with agency. It's not, I would say, an amazing example of that. But yeah, you know, I mean, just Rebecca Hall as an actress and the character of Sarah in this, I feel like are on the same zone where it's like, they deserve so much better. Like they deserve to be able to like break out of this and get agency. I mean, Rebecca Hall is the fucking best. I love to see her in everything.
Love her in The Town.
Yeah. And I mean, she loved her in Professor Martian and the Wonder Woman. Thank you very much.
The women.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's great.
Either.
We recorded our Wonder Woman episode a couple weeks ago, and I'm pretty sure like 40% of the runtime is me being like, okay, but you should actually watch this movie. It's quite good. And now she's broken into directing, which is great.
Yes.
Rebecca Hall Corner. And her movie sold for a lot of money at Sundance. So you know what?
This is Rebecca Hall Standcast, I guess.
It's really, really exciting. But yeah, I don't know. There's that line where Christian Bale is talking about how great of a life he had and how he and his brother both had a half-life, which was enough for...
I had a half-life.
Which was enough for them, but not enough for the women that they loved. And it's like, no fucking shit.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Lying to them every fucking day.
50% of your affection is not enough. What a concept. Oh, God, they're such disasters.
It's a mess.
I will say too, because it's like if she has agency, but it's like the only things that we know about her, she just shows up to this magic show with a nephew. So we know she like has a nephew and like went to a show. And then the only other like active agency she's kind of just like carried along by him this whole time is that she kills herself. And like,
but I do wonder too. If
off screen, well, she does, they show like the immediate like aftermath or whatever.
Right, right.
But like, I do wonder if like Chris Nolan is like capable of thinking like, there's nothing else she would do in this scenario. Like she wouldn't just like, I know women were also like limited at that time, but like, I don't think like, he could conceive of like, do we also think, I think it would maybe be realistic that she would grab their kid and like fucking bounce. Cause like,
oh my God,
husband,
get the hell out.
Cause she's picking
of there.
Up on like that he might be two people, but it's also so insane. They show like Scarlett Johansson's like cool as a cucumber breaking up with him and she just says he's cold. But something that like really got me this time was like, Freddie, I guess. Do they go by like Al and Freddie or are they both just Alfred?
I read a theory online that the twins are named Albert and Fred and that's why Alfred is like their portmanteau.
They're combined.
Name. Yeah.
Yes.
But I always think of it as like the Sarah twin and the, what is even ScarJo's name? The ScarJo twin. Oh my God. This is, let's see.
Does it matter? I mean, she's a woman.
No.
Olivia.
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 Right, right. Olivia. But okay, so he's talking to Olivia. And you also kind of gather the like dickish twin, right?
Yes. Oh God, Olivia. Yeah. There's definitely like one nice one and one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's two sides. And then the nice one liked Sarah and was willing to let his asshole brother like gaslight her and drive her to suicide. Anyway.
And show up at like the meal.
Yes. And he's just sitting there like sad. But like right. the indicative to me was like when he's when Olivia finally leaves him because she knows something's off, but she doesn't quite know. And Sarah was apparently going to reveal it to her. And he decides like this is the closest they come to like revealing the prestige of revealing the twins is he goes like the truth is I never loved Sarah. And you can see that he's trying to admit to her that, like, my brother technically did. So I'm not lying right. to you. My brother only loved Sarah, but I love you. And all she's hearing is, like, you never loved your dead wife? Like, what the fuck? Right. But, like, also, like he's psychopath. Operating. Right, but he's also operating under the logic of, like, no, you don't understand. I'm trying to tell you that, actually, my brother and I have been playing the same person our whole lives. And, like, I didn't love her, so that's fine. My brother did. I just pretended to love her sometimes and lied about it, our entire relationship. And then she committed suicide. That's cool, right? Are you also my brother might have fucked you at some point? Who knows?
You'll never know.
Like, which one actually had the kid? It's like they raised the kid together, but they're not like very yeah. clear about like which brother actually like had the kid with her. But then also if the way that I like viewed it at least is that the one who died was the one who loved Sarah more.
No. One who dies is the one who loves Olivia,
right? Because he apologized. Okay.
Yeah, because he's like, I apologize for Sarah.
Right,
as
right.
he's like yeah. walking to the gallows or whatever. But it right. is also like, oh, we took turns, and you're like, to what extent did you take turns?
This doesn't feel okay. I don't like that.
It's cool. I mean, I appreciate that no one seems to have the wherewithal to be like, yeah, these men are messed up. Like the idea, I love that. Like at the end, Hugh Jackman has paralleled Bale by living this half life himself.
He's like a 1/100th of a life at this point.
Yeah, he's yeah. basically splitting himself.
Photocopies.
Yeah, in half every night. So they end up as mirrors of each other, which I think is right. very thematically appropriate.
It's very Voldemort-y in the end.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, he's yeah. like basically like killing himself again and again.
Every night. Yeah. I mean.
For the bit, though, of course.
Just for the bit.
Commit to the bit.
Commit right. to the bit for your whole life. It must be so like weird to have been a magician as like a proper performer yeah. during this time. Yes. Like this is how you make your livelihood. It's I mean, what is God, is the modern equivalent like being a stand-up comedian? Like you go and you sell out like probably. Live audiences.
Well, it's like
to,
weird because this is like right
and...
before like the dawn of cinema too, because you have like Edison and right. Tesla having their right. like tete-a-tete as well.
Yeah, there's right. even that line from the theater owner where he's like, oh, you're done and I hired a comedian instead. Mm-hmm. I hate comedians. Like it's coming.
I mean, he knew. You don't date comedians, you don't date magicians.
Right, but like yeah, it's definitely very indicative. And again, watching The Illusionist, you're like, there's just like also nothing to do for people at this time. They just need like any form of entertainment, and like right, film's not a thing yet, so I'm like, I guess I'll just watch this man like make an ass of himself on stage or like a hot lady in some shiny little outfit.
Right, we'll objectify like the stage hand to distract from like the magic, which is like, oh, that's right. fun. Cool.
Yeah,
it's Friday at the theater.
My favorite element also of the like the prank war is just like, how do you guys keep picking the same guy like in the mustache? It's only like right when they look up where they're like, oh no. Oh, shit.
Right, it's
the
again
disguises
and again
aren't
it's,
even
they
good.
Look it's like no. the it's impossible not to tell that they're them. It's so funny. It's like, I'm gonna take off this mustache and he won't realize it's me.
I love the drama yeah. of them like gazing into each other's eyes and being like, oh shit, it's yeah. too late.
It's just so corny and campy. Like this is like, it's like very high camp.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know about high camp, Jordan.
It's like it's Chris Nolan doing what I mean, like Andrew. No, you like Batman versus Robin, and it's like love. Him doing what Schumacher does, but like to the nth degree, because like Schumacher like makes the world like sort of fit it, where Nolan he's just like, I'm gonna have these characters doing these bits, but the world is serious, and so then it just yeah. stands out even more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I love about Schumacher is apparently before like a lot of takes he would just be like, remember everyone, we're making a cartoon, because right. he grew up with like Batman's stupid, it's a man who dresses up as a bat to punch people. Like that's very like, that's drag, like that's like I'm putting yeah. on a show, I'm gonna like do my thing, but like I'm gonna wear eyeliner first.
But then the fact that no one then also makes Batman is hilarious.
Yeah, it is funny to me though, because but it's obviously that movie was famously like hated at the time because everyone was like too gay, like nipples and bulges, like we're not a fan. But like it makes me wonder if like if Schumacher like weren't gay, if that would have been like part of the conversation. Or I mostly say that because like watching this movie, if Christopher Nolan were like an out gay man, he would get questions about this nonstop, about like what, like why did you choose to have these two men? It was kind of homoerotic that they're doing it, but it feels like no one really had that type of conversation in 2006. No. I mean, yeah. This is also like around the same era. It's like it is funny to think of like how far we've come in terms of yes. like film criticism, in terms of like Brokeback Mountain. Like I was like a teenager when Brokeback came out, and it was like nothing but like two gay men are gay. Like fucking on a mountain, and then like they made all those jokes at the Oscars, like yeah. they're like it's fucking funny that these people are gay, and yeah, isn't that wild? Like that was the whole shtick for like 3 years. It was such a tired joke. And then like it's meanwhile awful. You have this film that's like these two men are pretty intense about each other, and like yeah no, but they just
but they're straight.
Like a little flair, they're straight, they have wives, so
who cares? Right, yeah,
like if you're right. married, you know, you can't be gay,
of course.
Duh.
Exactly. And god forbid we include like the greater queer umbrella,
right? Like oh my god, you're yeah. Boys, well, you, guys and girls. Oh
what a
God.
Concept. But I think you made a really good point, Ange, about like how far film criticism and like just, I don't know, film viewing has come even in the last 15 years, because I yeah. keep forgetting now, because I feel like there is like a very strong queer community and like queer critical community like online that is like standing up for these movies and defending them. But even like 10, 15 years ago, it was completely different, like a completely different yeah. conversation, a completely different like rating system. I mean, obviously we're still seeing it with sort of like the weepy gay prestige movie, and how not the prestige but the weepy gay yeah. like Oscar-y movie, how like prevalent that still is. But like I don't know, I was thinking about this the other day, just how like different the conversation around just like queer people as a concept and like portrayal mm-hmm. on screen has come in as little as like 7 years.
Oh my god, yeah.
It's nuts. And yeah, I totally agree that I think that if Nolan was a different kind of filmmaker, this movie would have enjoyed or not enjoyed a different kind of response to it. But he is so self-serious, and he is so like, you know, the classy man, the like the auteur who can do no wrong, especially at this point when he's coming like right off of Batman Begins, like rolling into Dark Knight. He's living the high life, like he's about to have like Inception coming up in 4 years. He can do no wrong, and like I don't think anyone bothered to look at this film through a sort of like critical lens, aside from the fact that like it's good, it's a masterpiece,
right?
As you were saying about Nolan, there's like a weird like sexlessness to his movies, like yeah, all of them are very like straight edge and very serious, as you were saying. So it's like within
the kiss in Inception, sex,
right? Yeah, it like feels awkward, and like when people like have relationships, you're like, this doesn't feel like, I don't feel like your connection. So then when yeah. they have mm-hmm. these male relationships, that's I feel like another part of the reason why like it jumps off so much.
Yeah, it reminds me, it seems like he isn't interested in like actual romance or actual chemistry, but he is interested in like having the hot girls there for the yeah. audience. I mean, it's sort of like the magician's hot assistant, like in right. the flesh, like you have someone there to distract the audience or to like call their attention to them, so that you're like, okay, great, well we got ScarJo in, you know, a bustier. Right.
Are you watching closely?
I will say, I think like a perfect encapsulation like of this film and like maybe of Chris Nolan is also like, and like the hidden queerness is that there's literally a scene where Hugh Jackman is making out with ScarJo, and he's so distracted, and she's like, what? And he's just like, I want to know his secrets. It's like, you have, and she was like famously this like bombshell, you know, right. at the time. Right. She was like really hot shit in 06, and you have oh, God, Scarlett yeah. Johansson and her big boobs in your face, and you're like thinking so intensely about what is another the other guy man. Doing?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah, and she doesn't distract him, and there's not like a scene where she like kind of seduces him or something and then distracts him. He's like, okay, so I'm gonna need you to go in there and get his diary. Like, it's like that's how intensely he does not care about women in this movie.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious, actually, about you guys. So, like, we discussed a little bit, but I know I came out a few years, probably, 3 years after I left Emerson College? Famously, very gay school.
But correct.
Like, took me a hot minute to get there. I was, like, 25. And it is kind of funny rewatching, because, like, actually, now that I think of it, probably the first time I watched this, I thought I was straight.
That's what I was gonna ask you. Me too. If you viewed this when you were like straight, or like when you came out, and how that's like affected your viewing habit. Sorry.
Yeah, I was curious if you guys have kind of felt that with movies, because I feel like there's so many things, even like Lord of the Rings or things like that.
Oh
where
my
like,
god!
You hear the god, jokes. Yeah. The jokes were always big about like, you know, oh, they're actually queer, or whatever, they're gay. And, you know, it was just kind of like funny, ha ha. But like now that I'm like part of that community, I do like watch stuff and I go, gay. Like, that's pretty gay.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
And it feels weird saying that in that way. But like, mm-hmm. I am myself gay.
No, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But like, it's just interesting how stories kind of change, or like how I can feel like I can have certain conversations, or how I feel like I'm like, how did I not catch this before?
Totally,
but I also
clearly
didn't catch a lot of things for a while. So
takes a beat.
I know.
Takes a little
bit. Always, it's crazy how hindsight is 2020. I feel like when it comes to coming out, because I feel like we both actually came out post grad as well, technically post grad, and
literally like day of post grad,
day of graduation.
It's like, you know, like they tell you in college, you know, to experiment and have fun and learn to be yourself. And this, as you were saying, like at Emerson, like everyone, like a lot of peers, etc., came out, and I was like, you know, I'm gonna wait right till the end.
Yeah.
Emerson, just to clarify, Emerson every year is always like number one on the list of like queer friendly schools, like for kids to apply.
Like, why did
to.
We wait? What? Like, it's when everyone has their own journey.
Yes.
I guess you were saying, sorry.
No, but I mean, I agree. It's crazy how hindsight is 2020. You come out and then you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like 3 years of my life where I was just denying this for absolutely no good reason and being like, okay, but no, that's not like a queer thing. It's just like being open-minded. Like, I just love women so much, but not really in like a gay way. And then you know, a couple years later, you're like, oh no, definitely in a gay way. But here we are. But I think it's very interesting to watch films after you're out, and especially when you kind of like have this mindset in place. So basically, anytime Jordan and I watch a movie, especially when we're trying to see if it'll fit the podcast or not, is like, okay, we gotta like put the rainbow glasses on and see what's happening. But I mean, that's like the beauty of queer theory, and like we dress it up a little bit by saying that it is like a critical take, because it is. But it's just, I think that you're attuned to see things in a different way, and once it's brought to your attention, like a magic trick, like The Prestige, once you see it, you like can't really unsee it. And I feel like since we started this podcast, I've had like some of my friends and family that listen to it be like, yeah, you know, now I watch movies and I'm just am thinking about the homoeroticism. And I'm like, well, you're welcome. That's what I intended.
Go
ahead.
I mean, same. I mean, like, it's like after coming out, I feel like it's so hard to revisit a lot of like classics as a kid. Like one of my biggest things has been like, or not classic, but it's like recognizing like these older films, as you were saying, that have like these queer undertones, and being like, oh right, like this makes sense that people like have that read or whatever. At least for me, like I found like a comfort in coming out of like starting to like accept other films that I feel like were often put down or like labeled as gay, if that makes sense. So like like the Schumacher Batmans, or like A George of the Jungle, or things like that. It's like I loved those movies growing up, but it felt like you would be bullied, or like people would make fun of them, you know what I mean? And so like you kind of like closeted away in a way, but now that like you're out, it's like you kind of love the inherent camp that comes with it. I feel like has been like a big thing for me in like recognizing that.
Yeah, I feel like it's like we were saying about how film criticism has changed in that regard. Like Angie said, Lord of the Rings, watching Lord of the Rings over Christmas was actually, I feel like, an out of body experience. I was like, this, how did I never realize
two lovers on a journey?
They're so in love, it's crazy. And Sam. Frodo, it's something that you can embrace now and be like, I fully stand up for like this aspect of the movie, and it's something that I can like champion. Yeah, and it's nice because we all need a little bit more of that. And of course, like, you hope to see more explicit stuff on screen in the next couple of years. Yeah,
I think, unfortunately, that's also part of it, is like the gay community is like so deprived of like any type of representation that we're like, there are undertones, and it's like, because there's no overtones. Like, that's why I was on Tumblr. Now it's so funny how like TikTok is just like rehashing like all of these trends now.
Like season one Tumblr drama.
Yeah, I was in the trenches. I was on Tumblr in like 2013, 2015, whatever. And I was never, I like watched Doctor, no, I didn't watch Doctor Who. What am I talking about? I watched Sherlock, and I like watched those shows, but I wasn't. I had to by law.
I was right there with you,
right? Yeah, but like, I wasn't like super into the Tumblr. I was unfortunately still very deep in Harry Potter, but that's a whole other thing. But I wasn't that bad. I think I was in high school, and then I got to Emerson, and I was like, oh, you guys are embarrassing. So I was like, I need to scale it back a little bit. But anyway, but it just reminded me, my friends and I were just talking about like, a girl I'm dating is like, was talking about the John Locke, I guess. I was like, what is that? And it's like, that's the like fans just going like, they touched fingers here. And that actually was like a callback to this. It's like, we are so desperate for anything that we've created elaborate systems and universes in which like these two characters fucked at some point.
Right. Yes. I mean, like, that's like, as you were saying, like a lot of the thing, like we want half the time, it's like, or majority of the time, like we want to like actually like have like a film where it's like very clearly like textual or like something that you can easily have a deep read on. But then there's those other things where it's like, especially even like with this movie, like there is a very concrete like reading you can have, but then it's also like they're reading each other's diaries, like, of course,
you know, it's what I mean? Right, it's
like
there
the lengths that we have to go to just to find like representation in a fun way where it's not just, you know, them being killed off, like love Brokeback Mountain, but it's just like, how many times do we have to watch like gay people be killed on screen?
It's all about the lens that you watch it through. Like, you can watch this The Prestige through a straight lens, no problem, but it is all about like how you want to look at it. It's interpretation, that's what movies are all about. But I have to say, I was also on Tumblr during the years of 2013 to 2015. It was a wild fucking time. I remember Sherlock extremely well. I was also very deep into Supernatural, which I'm sure if you were on Tumblr at that point came across your dad. Oh boy. More than once. I remember the Harry Potter fandom too. Okay, it's like, it's a very weird subset of like 4 years, and if you were on Tumblr during those 4 years, like there are things that are just burned into your brain that you're never going to be able to unsee. And like, you remember all of the crazy conspiracy theories and stuff like that, and like, I remember the Sherlock finale and how insane it was, and everyone was really pissed because John and Sherlock didn't end up together.
Right.
It was a disaster. I was right there. I was right there with you. And then you get to college and you're like, oh God, I can't
let this
out of this anymore. But I grew up in New Hampshire in the middle of nowhere. And I feel like, unfortunately, Tumblr was my like window to like this world of like inclusion and diversity and representation. And that's part of why I wanted to go to like a super, super like inclusive liberal arts school like Emerson. Was like, I like this online community and I want to experience it IRL. But of course, that means that the first, you know, exposure that you have to like diversity and inclusion is literally Tumblr, which is a disaster. It's like the inmates running the asylum. It's just a bunch of 15-year-olds running around screaming about fictional characters.
Well, I think that point it's interesting. Like, growing up in Massachusetts was very weird because, you know, like Massachusetts, like, hey, this is like very like democratic, progressive, liberal place, but like everyone suppresses their feelings a lot. And like, no matter how like inclusive or how, you know, like loving, it is very hard to sometimes come forward with like your feelings or like sexuality. And there is sort of like this undercurrent of, you know, judgment for everything.
Did you feel that?
Did you feel that?
Oh boy, did I? Yeah. I think like a good summary of like Massachusetts like liberalism is like Elizabeth Warren with her like rainbow feather boa scarf. So it's like, we do have that. We do have like a very straight middle-aged white woman just being like, yeah, you go. And we're like, wow, we support the gays. But like, I think my experience at Emerson, and like, I don't want to like blame specific people for this, but like, I remember I had queer friends who at the time identified it as lesbians. And I do feel like there was kind of like if you guys understand, this is bisexuals of like, yes. Like, you are not gay enough. So like, I just felt, I grew up in high school, like, quote unquote, only having crushes on boys.
Right.
And it's so funny to me now because like, I thought, I'm like, yeah, you know, always thought girls were like pretty and awesome and great, but like, I never had any crushes, so it doesn't count.
Right, right.
And yes. Like, and I also don't think like bisexuality was like honestly in my vocabulary.
Ever
I
totally about,
agree.
No, absolutely
no,
not.
All through, it was like you're one or the other. There's like a whole episode of Sex and the City, which I feel like is probably very definitive.
Oh, yes.
Of,
oh,
like,
yes.
Right. So it's just like, and there's no room for nuance. It's just like very black and white. And I weirdly kind of went from like the very just like, oh, straight people go here. And I was kind of like, I want to go to like a slightly more tolerant, like different. I want to meet different people. And I went to Emerson, and like, you might know this. Did like a lot of kids from your school go to like UMass Amherst?
Oh my God. My girlfriend senior year, again, same thing where I was just like only dated girls in high school, went to UMass Amherst. So it was just like ZooMass, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Same. So at my school, it's called the sequel. Like, cause like, that's just like where everyone went. And I could have gotten there and it probably would have been like the same amount, but I was like, I don't want to just be around the same people. And I do think that was like part of like the queer part of my brain being like, go somewhere different and like get out. Gay, but we'll get there later.
It'll take some time.
Right. But then I was at school the whole time and I didn't feel like I was like gay enough, or like, what, I eventually had a boyfriend for a while.
Oh my God.
And we
had the same all thing. Had the same experience.
Bisexuality is, I feel like that's such a nuanced thing that no movies really ever dig into with bisexuality. Or no. I mean, there's like, what bisexuality on screen anyways, but it's like how bisexuality, I feel like, it's felt in Massachusetts or wherever, anywhere, it's just like you're never enough either way. It's like you're gay or you're straight. It, like with queer friends or just like in the queer community, often feeling like exiled because you have, like, you could be like seen as like passing because like you're with, you know, like a girl or a guy or whatever. That room for nuance is really kind of just like shoved away.
And sort of like the like dating of one gender precludes like any ability for the other. You're like, if I'm a girl and I like boys, that means that I'm not gay because I like boys. And like, that is the end of the discussion. So it's a good, weird, difficult time. But
it's really
I don't know. I don't have like a nice little bow to wrap it up.
Have
in.
You? Oh, sorry.
But I'm glad we are talking about it.
Well, I can tie it back to Nolan.
Go in for it.
Yeah, there
like
we go.
You, with you, as like we were saying, like from like with queerness, have you like rewatching Nolan movies, or like has your relationship changed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like watching any movie, right? Like you relate to the character because you're like, oh, I do those things, or you relate to different people because of that. And like, once you kind of discover this like bisexual side of you, or once you realize, you know, like the line about like, oh, once you know it, it's actually very obvious. It's kind of like,
oh my God.
Right. So that's what was jumping out to me this time, is like, I can see parallels about like putting on the performance, or kind of like not wanting to let certain people in on a secret, or like, there's this whole thing Christian Bale has about like, once they have the secret, then like, they don't want you anymore, or which I don't necessarily is, I don't think equates to like the full queer experience or whatever, but there's a certain type of like sense of self that's like gone. He's like afraid of coming out. And also, I guess I'd say watching this, we've been saying they're like queer or gay, or it's like there might be some validity to like both Christian Bale's liking women. Right. That's like pretty bisexual. I'm trying to think of like if there's other movies where it's like kind of like a very clear interest in both women and men, but like it's almost like never explicit. Like I can't think of any movie characters that are like,
it's very,
I am bisexual.
It's very, very rare. I think like the one that we talked about on this podcast that was the most explicit was Atomic Blonde, right?
Probably.
Like, oh yeah,
but that's like, that is basically an island in a sea of nothing. Yeah, it's very, and yeah, I think that for some reason there is a reluctance to like say the word bisexual. Even though it's much more common to have these like open characters on TV instead of on film, it's usually like they just show them dating a character of the gender that you didn't expect them to be dating, and that's kind of the end of it, which is cool. But yeah, there's like a lack of acknowledgement there. I love what you said though, Ange, about that quote about once people know they don't want you anymore, because it I don't know, like who knew that you know magic and performance would track so well on sort of like the queer sliding scale of you know metaphors. But I mean the conclusion of this movie is Olivia, Scarlett Johansson, literally breaking up with Bale and being like, you two deserve each other. Like, that's where you belong.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
literally how it ends.
The conclusion that they come to.
You were that thing you're saying, like that if you're dating someone and like coming out to them is such like a big fear, especially if they are like if you're like dating someone of the opposite gender or whatever it
is. Gotta tell them that you're bi or
right, whatever. Like that first like initial, I feel like the barriers are being broken down now. Sorry, like this is all over the place, but
no,
it's like
yeah,
that thing
where
you're like telling someone that you're queer, even if you're out. I feel like especially like to be at the beginning aughts of a relationship is such like a weird feeling, just because you're like, I know that like even if you're out, you're like, I'm comfortable in my sexuality, but like, will the other person like be okay with that?
You
like
still gotta have the conversation
still, even though like it might not even be a secret. Just like a weird feeling to have.
Yeah. No, I've actually, now that I think of it, like there's definitely, I've gone on dates and it is kind of, if I go on a date with a man, I do kind of like, I don't necessarily bring it up on date one. I might say on like date, I might say date two or like, oh, I'm seeing this girl, blah, blah, blah. I'm bisexual, by the way. Or like, I'm like, I went to this Janelle Monáe concert. I'm bisexual, by the way. Like that's like how I like slide that in. And then like, I feel like I should probably say it more immediately to gauge like the type of person this is, or like,
yes,
maybe I try to like present myself as like a little more queer, but I also think straight men aren't necessarily always more attuned to that. But then like you do have that in like the other end of the spectrum of like, I haven't personally run into it. I feel like I've ended up on like a lot of dates with like bisexual girls. Or just like I've dated girls that are like bisexual, but like 1% men, you know what I mean? It's a scale or whatever.
It's a spectrum. Yeah.
But you also see there are women who are like, I'm not interested if you're like not a lesbian or
gotta
whatever.
Be a,
and it's
a
just kind of like,
lesbian,
all right, cool.
Great.
Like you're not, I'm like, I guess I just don't want to be with that person anyway. But there is like a part of you that's like, you can't win either way sometimes.
Right. Like, what did I do?
And you're not quite sure how people's perception towards you is going to change, even if you think that it won't like change necessarily negatively, but that it's like going to shift a little bit. I feel like it's weird to decide if you want to come out to people at work, because it's like,
God, the work thing is,
you work with them. You don't necessarily like, they don't necessarily need to know that. But like, I feel like especially we both work in the film industry, like a lot of times we're evaluating projects that are coming in with like queer content, and you want to like be able to champion it with like a little bit of you know weight behind the words, like I care about this specifically because blank blank blank.
But I feel like all of mine with that, it's like I don't feel like I've ever fully come out to my bosses or anything, but they know now, like they'll kind of like ask like from a queer POV, but it was always just because like you would say like, you know, like as like a queer or like you like try even... to like slip it in some way.
Yeah.
Hard. I love the Janelle Monáe concert. I'm going to start using that one. I usually will be like, yeah, I mean, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, definitely my favorite film of last year. I just thought that that was really incredible, and just kind of wait and keep talking about it until someone's like, oh, I see, and then quietly melts away.
Or you just
away.
Talk how much you like, I cuff everything. Shirts always cuffed, jeans always
That's
cuffed.
Like the thing now, I'm learning all this stuff from like the TikTok teens. I don't like post on TikTok, but I've also Twitter has become this like cesspool that like is too negative.
Awful.
So I just kill time with TikTok, and it's kind of interesting how it's like it's very Tumblr-ish. It's like I like that kids like have this arena in which to kind of be like openly queer, but it is also like, oh, if you're bisexual, you always have this haircut. And I'm like, I don't know if that works for me though, because my hair's curly or whatever. It's
wait, do
little,
I get
it's
that?
A little boxed in.
Oh yeah. I feel like I accidentally walked, because I'm not being on TikTok. I feel like I walked straight forward into like the cuff thing, like immediately after coming out. I just started cuffing, and it's just been like a thing since then.
I cut my hair short about 2 months before I came out. I used to have like—
Did you really?
Yes, I used to have like very long, like, you know, flowy straight girl hair, and I chopped it and I was like, okay, I'm ready now.
Yeah, I had very long— I had like hair down to here. It's usually about shoulder length. And then I like went on like one date with this girl I like really liked, and I was like, oh, I'm bi now. And then I pretty shortly after that like got a pixie cut, and it was also because I was like, I've had a pixie cut before, and I'm like, oh, I just like wanted to do it. But looking back, I also did roller derby at the time. I did roller derby before I realized I was gay. It feels like every part of my brain was like, let's just like test some of this shit out.
like before... what's gonna get to her?
Just like drop in some really heavy hints. It's funny that you brought up the cuffing thing, though, because actually it reminded me, my sister cuffed my jeans first. Like, I was just, like, home, and then she just, like, bent down and, like, cuffed my jeans for me, and I was like, what? And she was like, they look bad that way. You have to have them like this. My sister is also a bisexual, I should specify.
We love to see it.
Yeah. And came out before me, so I think that's also, like, telling about—
very indicative.
Yeah, different generations, and, like, there's very short span of time, but, like, very different high school experience.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Exactly.
That's— I mean, I even look at, like my sister's high school experience is so— she's like 3 years younger than me, and like how progressive, like so many of her classmates came out and all that stuff, and I was like, no one in my school— like I had maybe one person out in my school, maybe.
Yeah.
But like the minute people graduated high school or college, it was like 13 people, and you're like, oh, like what happened? Like, why couldn't this have happened before?
Were you a Catholic school kid?
I didn't go to a Catholic school, but I was an altar server for 10 years.
Yo! Me too.
Which, like, you don't tell people. If you want to be a real buzzkill at a party, tell them you're from Massachusetts and you're an altar server. And they just watch the, like, them get really sad and, like, not know what to say next. And I'm like,
they're like,
fine.
Have you seen the film Spotlight? Like, do you want to talk?
Of their eyes. Oh, God damn.
Like,
it.
I was literally just like, I didn't quit because of Catholic guilt. It wasn't like anything horrible happened. It was just like a very poor church, and there weren't a lot of kids like signing up to be an altar server, so I was just literally there until I graduated, and I was like, I'm going to college, I like can't do this anymore.
It's been a good run.
But like the thing you said about, right, like being in New England, it's like, you know, like liberal bashing or whatever, but I had a very similar experience where it was like, my— because I have friends from the Midwest who, like, I think some more kids were out maybe weirdly, but like for me, I, you know, there was like one or two kids that were like gay. No one said anything about it. You just kind of like knew. But I was like, no one like held hands. Like, you would not be a couple and hold hands in our school. Like, that was just like,
correct. Yeah.
Gonna
happen. Totally. Like, forbidden.
But I was like, my school wasn't homophobic. Like,
right.
Yeah.
It's like we were out, like, we all like voted for Obama or whatever. But then it's like, but like, no one was out or like could kiss. Cool.
Yeah.
It's exciting to see how it's evolved in a very short time. And how different it will be in 5 or 10 years from now, even.
Maybe we'll have a bisexual lead of a movie.
Oh, what a concept.
You never know.
Yeah.
Could be great. I mean,
yeah, I guess now that we're talking about it, I don't think I've really ever heard it like uttered on screen.
No.
Like, there's some—
it's extremely rare. I have, let's see, I feel like I had a horrible like jolt of, oh, fuck, when I was watching Bohemian Rhapsody. And Freddie Mercury has that line where he's like, I think I'm bisexual. And his girlfriend goes, you're gay, Freddie. And that is the end of it.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, no. And then I was waiting for them to bring it back and be like, you know what, actually. Wait, and then it just never comes back.
I have a quick question. You're saying that the movie Bohemian Rhapsody really didn't dig into these potent themes about sexuality, about Freddie Mercury at all?
Well, hint, hint.
It wasn't a good movie?
Let's not get into it too much because we're going to be into it in a couple weeks anyway.
Mess of a movie.
It sucks. It's very rare, and especially I think like in, I mean, that's the whole reason we wanted to do this podcast on film and not TV, is that you have like the almighty box office like pushing forward and like needing to like remove any trace of like queerness from these blockbusters in order to like sell them globally and to like get the most bang for your buck, even if it doesn't always work successfully, or even if you end up accidentally or on purpose making an extremely homoerotic movie. Like, the idea is that you have to hide it because it's not widely accepted. And like at the end of the day, it's all about the money.
But should we tie back to a certain third part of a magic trick?
The Prestige?
The Prestige.
Oh, baby.
The Prestige.
I mean, I don't know. The plot, it's like so convoluted. I feel like the best part about the whole movie is really the performances. Like, I love Jackman in this.
He's awesome.
I feel like he's just
great. He's the greatest showman.
This is the greatest show.
I really appreciate that they were like, okay, we're going to find a double for you. Oh, look, we found Hugh Jackman nose. Like, yeah. I totally forgot that they just cast another Hugh Jackman.
It really is throwing. Like, the first time you watch it, you're like, is that Hugh Jackman? And then you immediately realize it is.
It is.
But he's making fun of himself in it.
But I'm surprised that they didn't cast someone else. Like, I love that they didn't, but that's like, that is a choice.
Yeah.
To just totally, they don't even bother to disguise him.
No.
That is like a pretty ballsy move. I think like in the bar, there's parts of it where I'm like, did they even like do enough to make him look like quote unquote different? But like, there's this scene in the bar, he does look the most like his jawline's like maybe not as sharp, or his nose is like a little more pointed and his teeth are bad. But it is still like very weird to like, and he's playing specifically like an out of work actor. Like,
I used to be
pathetic.
Caesar.
Right. It's hilarious.
Is this his best? I mean, I don't know. This is I feel like this is probably top three Jackmans for me. It's like this, Logan, like Bad Education, which again, Bad Education, good queer movie.
Oh yes, but Bad Education rocks. I love that movie.
I feel like it's just tapping into so much of what Jackman's persona. You know what I mean? Like him hosting the Oscars,
best Oscar intro.
Yes. Oh my god, yeah.
Like, it's he's a iconic, big, muscly guy who loves to sing and dance.
Right.
And like,
he loves to jump around the stage.
Seems like a genuinely, like, pretty cool dude. And so I love whenever he's in something, because I feel like he's able to imbue it with a sense of, like, sensitivity. And, like, he knows what he's about, even though he did, like, you know, make his money in the superhero genre. Like, he is an actor.
Yeah,
I was just gonna say, like, now that we're saying, I really love Jackman in this. And again, after watching The Illusionist, you watch like Bad hamming it up, and then like someone hamming it up, like the scene where he's just like, "How do you not know?" Like yelling over his dead wife or whatever. Like that, it was like a little extra, but you're like, I buy this guy being like
totally
that anger kind of fueling the whole thing. But it just hit me that like, both characters, like, how much do each of these actors like have to stretch? Because Hugh Jackman,
not a lot, a
Broadway singing like star, plays a guy who's great at showmanship, who like is extremely dedicated to the craft, or the, you know, the stage of it all, and bowing in front of everyone. And then you have Christian Bale, who we know has like lost severe amounts of weight, or gained severe amounts of weight, and gone to like total extremes to convince everyone of his part. And what does his character do? He's completely dedicated to the craft his entire life, so much that he physically harms himself to keep everyone under like the spell of his job. Like, they Chris Nolan really nailed the casting on this one.
Yes.
He's just he's like so contemptuous about like the world, and just is like such like a bottled anger, and you like you have all those Bale outbursts on set and everything. It's like, you're like, this is Christian Bale playing Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, if he was like 5% more unhinged, right. Basically.
Yeah.
Not like Russell Crowe and unhinged. Yes.
I think that this is one of that is why this movie like works extremely well and isn't sort of like the cool film take that this is the best Nolan movie.
Yes.
Like if you're basic, you think Inception is the best movie. If you're a fake film person, you think that The Dark Knight is the best Nolan movie. And if you're like smart and cool, you think that The Prestige is the best Nolan movie.
Yeah.
I think Inception is the best movie.
Is Prestige your favorite of them all? Or?
It was... I've realized in quarantine, I think we've talked about this a little bit on Blank Check, or just the idea of like, I love a good puzzle movie, like where all the pieces are kind of laid out and it's not till the end where you like scale back and like look at the whole picture. Like, I love a good heist. Like, Logan Lucky is probably one of my favorite movies.
A fabulous
movie. I just watched Reservoir Dogs. Yeah. He's so good. And Daniel Craig, masterpiece. But like,
so
Quentin Tarantino is someone who like, again, it drives me a little crazy, is sexist, racist, and like, that's like a whole other thing. I can't quite get in. I'm like a white woman, so I don't know how much I can speak to it. But you definitely watch it and you're like, I feel like you maybe could have scaled that back a little bit. But like, arguably, I'm like, oh, Jackie Brown's so good. But
I love Jackie Brown. Yeah.
Fuck, what was I going to say? I haven't rewatched it, but I really love Dunkirk. Like, whoa. I don't know. I should watch it again. But I just thought it was like, I think that's when like the timeline element like really works. And I gotta say, I love Kenneth Branagh taking off a hat. Like, I love like
the right amount of ham.
Yeah. Also, if this is again total sidebar tangent, if you guys haven't seen, have you guys seen Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein?
No.
Me
too. I've seen pictures of it.
My God. The best thing I've watched in quarantine. He plays Victor.
Isn't he like very hot in it?
Right? He at one point is totally shirtless, covered in oil, and that's when he's like, he's bringing the monster to life. And he's like running up and down, like he's like in an attic that's his lab, and he's like sprinting back and forth and like pulling on chains. And like, it just reminded me of like that one shot in New Girl where like the old woman's like, yank that chain. Like, I was I was watching it like that, like, am I hot for Kenneth Branagh? Have I been inside this long that like I kind of get it now? Like, he's... Which again, like, he directed it, so he's just like, I'm gonna make myself so
look
sexy.
Yeah.
But like, Helena, it's also about a man like so obsessed with the craft that he goes a little crazy, and all the women in his life die. Helena Bonham Carter, Helena Bonham Carter plays like his wife and slash adopted sister, Robert De Niro is
the monster.
The monster. Yeah. So like, I can't say enough for, again, we're like way off track, but
this is great.
If you want to watch a movie and just like do like the monster, but like in a De Niro voice for like 2 hours, like me and my friends did.
Oh my God, that sounds a dream.
What did you make me? I don't want to come to life.
A fire's bad.
Yeah. A little bit. I don't like fire.
Oh my God.
A little bit of fire over there. Yeah, it's...
I would love to see Jackman's Van Helsing then meets this Frankenstein.
That's a pretty good double feature.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love that. I'm very glad that Kenneth Branagh finally achieved his goal of making himself hot in a movie. Like, I feel like
he never does that.
He goes into every movie being like, I am the sexiest motherfucker in this piece of media.
I have two mustaches and I will still look like I fuck everybody.
You gotta respect it, you know?
Yeah.
Ugh. I feel like I have leftover Kenneth Branagh feelings for Much Ado About Nothing. A very sexy movie.
Another movie he directed.
And of course.
He looked very sexy. But you know what? He made sure Keanu and Denzel look great too.
The Keanu's all oiled up in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, he really oils up. It's like the budget. He must make sure there's just like a big bucket.
$1 million
offset.
For talent. Here's like the production line. Oh, interesting. Oil, just like
$50,000.
What the fuck? It's overall, it's fine.
That sounds great. I'm definitely gonna look that up. Speaking of interesting casting choices, I can't get over Robert De Niro as Frankenstein.
That's incredible.
Jesus, or as the monster, excuse me.
Yeah, you gotta get it right. He's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Can we talk about David Bowie in the fucking Prestige?
Yes.
Incredible.
Is this maybe the coolest casting choice ever?
You're forgetting his sidekick, the director of Venom, Let There Be Carnage.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Forgive Academy Award nominee Andy Serkis.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
This movie's full of, I forgot they were in this.
Well, the whole Colorado sequence is so weird. And it's but it makes, as you were saying, that Bowie thing, it makes so much sense. If we're going to look at it literally, because it's he feels, Bowie's whole thing is a man who fell to earth, you know what I mean? And Tesla, I feel has garnered that persona in the internet age. He's become so cool. It's Edison versus Tesla and every, the cool thing is to say Tesla. And so I feel he kind of imbues that. And I feel this was maybe on the beginning of that. So he sort of carried maybe some weight into that.
Yeah.
I don't know, but.
I think it works well for the sort of sci-fi revisionist history element of it too, to have this man who is not technically most known for being an actor, to have this guy that's kind of unknowable and mystical, bring the sci-fi element into your otherwise extremely grounded movie.
Right. Making a cloning machine.
Yeah, exactly. Cause it's the whole thing is about, how do you know the trick? It's just sleight of hand. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's something real. To introduce a sci-fi element, I think, is risky. And so Bowie is there to kind of help shoulder the load and be of course it's David Bowie. He can do whatever he wants.
The movie has that weird thing where it treats magic. It's sort of half and half, where half of it, it's is magic real? You know, it has that sort of element where you see it and then the whole thing is wondering if Bale actually can do magic, and then revealing, you know, I feel it plays with the idea of is magic real? Then you actually have real magic a little bit, if that makes sense.
It's the illusion versus is it actually happening? And then I think it also gets in the conversation of is science really just magic? It is kind of that impressive.
It is. I think it goes thematically with their characters too. Bale is the lower class kind of scrappy guy who has to make it with what he already has. And Jackman has all the money in the world and is ready to literally invent cloning to make his dreams happen.
Also is on the run. He could just totally find a way to use that machine, make some henchmen, clone some guys, just kill Edison's men or something.
You should have kept a couple backup clones just hanging out in case Bale decided to come in and shoot him.
Right. Oh wait, yeah. Also,
gotta have some plan B.
I know.
I was thinking, how does he work out the kinks of that magic trick? So technically, the first time you do it, do you not kill yourself, or you have that other clone, but then do you have to have a conflict? He basically seems he has to keep killing himself so there's only one Hugh Jackman, because then things are gonna get complicated.
Definitely.
I guess the only logic I can kind of ascribe to it is it went horribly wrong when he had Root, I think, is quote-unquote ugly Hugh Jackman. So he's obviously things got messy when there was two of me before, so I have to kill myself every night and hope my consciousness hops over. Once you get into that, it's very confusing.
He kills in the way that his wife died as well, which is over the top and excessive. The first time he kills himself, it's with a gun, and he's oh god, I gotta kill me. But then
you're right,
he has killed himself before, but now he's just doing it just to get back at Bale. But does killing himself the way his wife died is just so insane.
Really, I forgot, because there's that scene where he's drowning himself in the sink right after he's mourning to see what it was like. And that Michael Caine line is brutal, where he's you know, when I told you that thing about it being peaceful, I did that to make you feel better. Agony. So you put yourself through agony every night. And back to the David Bowie thing is David Bowie's think about the cost. And he's I've got all this money. Who cares? And he's no, the cost. I'm trying to tell you about the Voldemort thing. A piece of your soul is going to probably die a little bit every time you do this. I want to look up the quote that David Bowie, there is a line when they're having that little tea time where he just says something about the grasp of man. And then he looks off into the distance.
I have it right here. It's
Oh, great.
I was going to, I can't do
don't do that. Don't.
You're
even.
Familiar with the phrase, quote, man's reach exceeds his grasp. It's a lie. Man's grasp exceeds his nerve.
Ooh.
Dramatic look out into the distance.
Yeah.
The fallibility of man. I think they explain the whole clone thing more in the book. This is based on a
There's
book.
A book?
This is based on a novel. Oh. I have never read it. I'm sure it is perfectly average. Yeah. But I mean, it's a great initial concept. But I think they explain the cloning thing more, and they get really into the nitty gritty of like, what does it actually mean when you create a clone? Does he like have his memories and his emotions? Yeah. Or is he sort of like this half-life shell of his former self? Like, is he basically like a man without a soul, but still like has the capability to technically like walk and talk and all of that good stuff?
Yeah,
I don't know. It's weird to think about.
You just mentioning that is wild, because I feel like Nolan constantly talks about like how obsessed he is with Blade Runner and the fact that this
is his only
movie like with clones or robots or anything like that. Like, not robots, but like this feels, I guess, the most in line with Blade Runner of his like ode to that, like what is like real and like what is man. It's interesting that you said that if the book goes more into that, and that he avoided that, because I feel like he would have been interested in that.
Yeah,
I don't know,
it's a pretty long movie already, there's not a ton of time. But I feel like Nolan's sci-fi sensibility is like very time-based and very like manipulation
of
space. Hot take. I think he's kind of into time. But like, he never talks about, you know, the folly of man or anything like that. It's mostly about like man's place in the world and how they can like manipulate that, how you can make the elements work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's also man versus nature, man versus thing, and this is very clearly like man versus man.
Yes,
like head to head frustrations
mono and mono
over who's a better at lying to crowds and crowds of people every
who's
night.
Who's better at pulling the little rabbit out of the hat? Who's better at making little birdie disappear? It's really ridiculous. It's when you think about it.
You look at this movie and it has so much in common with The Dark Knight Rises, weirdly, like with the prison sequence and like the diary going to him in Bale, then needing to like work up like enough courage to like to get out of prison. It's
Michael
just, like,
Caine retires and he's drinking like coffee at this like little bar at one point. I'm like, this is the exact shot like at the end, or he's like,
when it's he has, a young like, man's the card game. On the bottom.
Yeah.
I wish you had actually died when the thing exploded. Or no, what is it? In The Dark Knight, he like wants to see him happy or married or whatever it is.
You can't talk to me about The Dark Knight trilogy. I do not remember enough to be any sort of help.
He said at the funeral, he says, right, like, he thinks at this point Christian Bale has died. And he goes, I failed you. I failed you. And like, eventually he gets his kid at the end. And also in Inception, he helps reunite
the family.
Leonardo DiCaprio with a blonde child sitting in a field. That's the happy ending to all.
I wonder if Chris Nolan had just like a wise old sage figure in his life that did help him out at some point.
I think it was Michael Caine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Nolan's brother was like a con man. So it is interesting that like his not Jonathan, but the other one. So it is interesting that this movie is like very much about like cons. And I mean, all of his movies are like very heisty.
Men lying their entire lives.
Right. Yes.
Like, Nolan, do you want to process some stuff, honey?
Yeah.
Like, we can talk.
We talk a lot about, like, I feel like it's very common knowledge. Oh, you know, every filmmaker, every auteur making a movie is, like, in part a response to the movie they just made and is also, like, secretly about them. Like,
yeah.
We all know this. I feel like Nolan gets, like, a little more shit than usual, though, because his like themes are so transparent and so consistent that you're like, shouldn't you have worked through this dead wife thing? Like, it's been 15 years.
Yeah.
But he just keeps coming back to the well.
Have such a lovely relationship, which is so wild.
And that's great for them. I think he just needs to, you know,
to move on, keep a wife alive.
Yeah.
Well, one wife.
Elizabeth Debicki lives in Tenet, right?
Yes, she's just massively abused.
Oh, great. That's so much better. I see another situation where it's like, why doesn't she just leave his ass?
No,
like, we can't conceive of the fact that you can like get yourself out of a shitty situation.
Or he can maybe try like the screenwriting 101 thing where he can just write a whole movie that's a man and then just cast a woman and then like see if that like explodes his own brain, or if that's something like he can even manage. Like, it's not that big of a jump. Like, we don't, I hesitate to, I would be a little concerned. I wonder what that would be like, a woman leading a Chris Nolan movie.
But if it was like Lupita Nyong'o instead of John David Washington in Tenet, like, she and Robert Pattinson probably would have smooshed at the end.
It would have been great.
Just saying. I think it would be cool. It's really not a difficult concept. Like, you don't especially in Nolan movies where there isn't a ton of like gender politics except for bad ones. Like, it's not really about like being a man specifically. It's more about just like being a person who happens to be a man. Right.
Well, and then failures are marked with like death of women, like, yes, Rachel and Sarah.
Rachel.
And Julia. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's like, but that is more a sort of consequence as opposed to like deeply woven, right, into the fabric of the movie. I think that's why he gets a lot of flack too. Like, his women don't have to die. He just like kills them for convenience because it's like, right, an easy way to get an emotional buck from the audience. But he could have a female lead extremely easily. And I don't think it would change the fabric of his movie as much as he might think it would. I don't know. We'll see. He hasn't even announced his next project after Tenet, right?
No. All we know is he's probably bailing from Warner Brothers because he's like, yes, very pissed about this HBO deal.
I mean, yeah, same.
I would be.
Yeah.
Such a mess.
It's so bad. What did you think of like Tesla? I guess it's going back a little bit.
Yeah.
But no, like,
yeah, rewind.
I don't know enough about Tesla, but like, isn't like the story that he's like, the thing I remember hearing growing up is that like he died a virgin, and now it's kind of something where you're like, oh, he was probably like asexual,
or at least queer.
That's just like what I've heard like ascribed to his personality, and like the story is that like he was like the real genius. Tom Edison like stole his shit, which obviously ties into like the two in this movie. So he was trying to drop parallels. But very I just thought it was interesting that like he gets played by David Bowie, like a very kind of like gender bending type of man. And like, I genuinely can't remember what the like root of like, how does a rumor get spread? How does that like become a defining thing of like, this man died a virgin? Like, did he like journal about it? Or is it just one of those things where people are like, he only had a male roommate his whole life? And like, they were good bets.
Furiously on his Wikipedia page, and here's what I have found. Tesla was a lifelong bachelor and had once explained that his chastity was very helpful to his scientific abilities. I think that sounds pretty ace-leaning to me. But he once said in earlier years that he felt he could never be worthy enough for a woman, considering women superior in every way.
All right,
let's go.
King.
Let's go, King. Let's go,
King. Not wrong.
Woke King Nikola Tesla.
He's entering our pantheon with Marty, Charlize. Right.
Oh my God. Yeah. I
feel like the Bowie thing is totally spot on, though. I mean, like, it is casting Bowie, like one of the most like flamboyant, you know what I mean, very fluid people, makes a statement no matter what, even though
he's a mystery man.
Right, but he's like very buttoned up in this, which is also like a little weird when you see then Bowie in like this very like quiet, astute sort of performance. Like, you kind of want him to be giving a little bit more camp to it, if that makes sense.
I like what he's doing in it, because I think that like he's playing it very straight, but like with a, you know, with like a wink to the audience. Like, you can tell that he's playing it straight very intentionally. It's not like a bland performance.
He originally said no to Nolan in casting, and he had to like rewrite for him to convince him.
Didn't Nolan like fly out personally and was like, I really want you. I can't think of anyone else for the role.
You look at like him, and then you look at Andy Serkis, and like Andy Serkis is the one sort of giving the unhinged performance where he's just like has his
voice. New Yorker.
I'm like, what is the voice you're giving here? He's like, oh, I love my cat so much.
It's so weird to hear him as a New Yorker.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I keep doing the Cockney thing. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
I think it also jumps out a little bit too, because everyone's like so British for so long, and you have like Michael Caine, and that's already in like one other end of the spectrum, and someone drops in, you're like, oh, I guess a person from this time can be from New York or whatever.
America.
And he's like, oh, I'm from New York. That's my impression of Andy Serkis doing character.
Spot on.
Maybe he and Tesla could have been lovers with their cat.
Okay, all right.
I will say the least realistic part of this movie is that cat stays like perfectly still while they're testing it. And he's just like, I'm just gonna sit here while all this weird shit's happening to me. I'm like, my cat would be fucking out the door running
so
all
quick
over this lab.
With the noise, like the lightning going on, the cat's just like, this is fine.
Not realistic.
I really do like the movie, but it's funny that like the logic is that they don't realize that all the hats in the cloning is working until he just like goes down the hill and like sees a pile of hats.
Gotta walk 20 feet
away.
Right. And like the other cats are there, and he's just like, oh, okay.
What cool. a concept.
Yeah.
I guess it worked.
Yeah. I like that they have the cats fighting. It's a nice little foreshadowing. Yeah. Even though I was sad because I don't want the cats to fight. I want them to be
friends. There
can
only be one.
yeah, this movie is wild. And yeah, I feel like we've basically,
I mean, that's like
in a roundabout way gotten through all of it. And do you have any final like big movie thoughts you'd like to leave us with before we move on?
Oh, big movie thoughts about this. No, I just think it's just funny talking about this and like being bisexual and like realizing like I don't know, it's always like kind of a complicated thing. You don't want to like assign sexualities to characters necessarily, but the idea that like both of these men split themselves in half in different ways mm-hmm. and are also involved with women, but also this part of them, they're obsessed with men but like don't really want to admit it, is like specifically very bisexual. And I don't think I ever really thought of it, you know, it's very easy to just be like, oh, this movie's pretty gay, but like in the way that I think queer people are like taking back and go like this scene is gay or whatever. But it is funny to like specifically actually be like, that's pretty similar to like the bisexual experience.
Totally.
Feeling like you're living a double life sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is literally like about like the two sides of someone, you know? And I mean, that's us. It's fun. Wow. It's great. Yeah. We love it.
This is just like us.
Crazy. We're very into magic.
Totally cool to be exactly like these two men.
Mm-hmm. Super healthy. Ends really well for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no secret that people fucking love this movie. It made quite a bit of money when it came out. The inflated adjusted domestic box office was $74 million.
This is his lowest.
Yeah.
Well, other than Tenet's.
But we can't really count Tenet. Yeah. But like, so, considering that this is his lowest rated movie is insane, because it like opened number one to 14 million, like, you know, in October, like in the middle of like Oscar ramp up season. Like, this is still a successful movie.
Yeah. People weren't just done with The Illusionist.
Correct.
They wanted more.
Isn't there a third magician movie that came out this year? And I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's a Woody Allen magic movie.
Oh, no.
Well,
so we don't need to talk about
talk about that one. That's so great.
Don't want to get into that psyche today.
No. If we're talking about 2006s, though, Hugh Jackman, this was a huge Jackman year.
Okay.
Because he was in Happy Feet, Flushed Away, The Prestige, The Fountain, Scoop, which is the other magic movie, and X-Men The Last Stand, all in one year.
Mostly like blown away by the fact that he was in Flushed Away and Happy Feet in the same year.
Yeah.
I was like, who was he? But I realized he plays the dad penguin, right? Mm-hmm. Who speaks with like an Elvis voice, if I'm correct.
He probably just walked in there. He's like, can I just do something? I keep going.
That's
my God.
Very British. Well, George Miller is sort of like, he collects all the Australians, right? Doesn't
Nicole Kidman mm-hmm. yeah, play opposite? She's got like a heart on her boob. Talk about like weird forced sexuality.
All animated movies, how they sexualize like girls and women, is just very weird, where it's like an animal but it has like boobs and you're like
I really
shouldn't have titties. It makes me uncomfortable.
I agree.
Don't put it on a shirt.
Just gonna write a letter to George Miller and be like, I know this came out.
Dear George,
ago, but
love
like,
some of your
this
work.
This is like important for like the Anya Mad Max.
Yes. Right.
Was this also when he hosted the Oscars?
I think it's around the same year. Maybe it's the year after.
This is Beyonce. This is also, I remember, because she comes out and she does the top hat thing. And I feel like that's around like the Sasha Fierce era. It was huge Beyonce. Also, a thing I should have realized, I was gay in college. I had 3 Beyonce posters in my dorm.
Whoa.
Not just one, but 3.
They were all from the movie
Obsessed.
Yeah, exactly. I was a huge fan.
Right, you were like that.
Obsession
Panther,
is a young man's game.
It is a young man's game.
No, they were like
Hugh Jackman. I love that. I love that so much. I know. It's crazy how often you look back and you're like, Jesus Christ. I remember telling one of my friends, I was like, a lot of girls run around here in yoga pants. It's very distracting. But like, you know, I don't think that means anything. And she was like, Brooke, are you sure? And I was like, no, I mean, you know, it's fine. I kid you not.
That's I hilarious. Had a Pinterest board called Abraham Lincoln's where I just saved pictures of like hot women. And I just thought, I'm like, these are cool women that I love and respect. And it's like Beyonce and Zooey Deschanel, who was like my desktop
bangs
background
or
at
no
one
bangs.
Point. Yeah. Definitely bangs. Yeah. Rinko Kikuchi.
Oh my God.
Helen Mirren, I'm pretty sure, is in there. Like,
great. When yeah. you said Abraham Lincoln at first, I thought you were going to say like girls in Halloween costumes like Abraham Lincoln. No. I was like, oh no, Ange.
No, really it was just like very clearly like, I'm going to save pictures of these like cool, I like these photos and I want to save them. I don't know why. And I'm like, but the title's going to be funny so that we're not going to address what this really is.
It's a bit.
It's just a fun bit, which is what Christian Bale does.
I was going to say, what is bisexuality if not commitment
if
to the bit?
If not committing to the bit.
Mm-hmm. Also, yeah. to answer your question, Hugh Jackman hosted the Oscars in 2009.
Okay. So he was
our
building
finest
up
year
to
of music.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the best year of music. I don't know. I'll have to go back and watch. That seems like it was a good Oscars. I think I was still slightly too young. My parents wouldn't let me stay up and watch them.
I really recommend
East Coast problems.
He does a musical opening number. And then this was the like the recession hit in 2008. So all the movies that came out that year, I think, were kind of like either a reflection of things or was talking about how budgets were like lower or whatever. So the big joke in the performance is that like they had to cut back on the budget for the musical number. So he's like singing in these like props. He's in like Benjamin Button came out. And I think like yep. his face goes into like a cutout. The fighter is like a boxing ring at
it's
one
a great,
point. The
it's
reader's
an incredible
the best part.
Opening.
In the ending, you have to watch just for the ending. I'll say that. The last line he sings. It's very funny.
All right. That's,
I think we'll have to tweet
that's
it
everyone's
out.
Homework. And yes, we'll definitely tweet it. That's everyone's homework. Go watch Hugh Jackman 2009 Oscars opening. And then maybe like Hugh Jackman greatest hits on YouTube.
Right. That's he's a great. Showman. He's the greatest
showman. He is the greatest showman.
I also keep saying that I still haven't seen that movie.
It's okay. I don't think you need to.
I feel like it honestly is really fun to watch a couple of years after it came out because basically everyone in that movie is now popping hardcore, like Rebecca Ferguson. Michelle Williams is in there.
Zendaya. Rose the Hat.
She is. Talk about a hat on a hat.
Hats on hats.
But like it's a deeply weird
it's
movie.
Unhinged
there's also
the
like,
unhinged.
A weird critic character in it, which is very interesting. Like it's definitely one of those movies that goes very hard on like the critic hate. Crazy third act fire business. I feel like it's a good double bill with Dumbo, not gonna lie to you.
True.
I highly recommend. It's very odd, very strange. So at the end of the episode we usually go around, say our personal ratings and then like our queer quadrant ratings. Personally, I gave this movie 3.5 stars, which maybe is a little low, but like I was like hovering between a 3.5 and a 4 and I just like couldn't quite get there. I do like this movie a lot. I'm just not a huge Nolan stan, but I really appreciate how this movie is constructed and what it does and how it does in fact pull the wool over your eyes and you want to be tricked and all of that good stuff. I think it is a very well crafted movie and I dig it. On the QQ, honestly, I'm gonna give this 3 stars. Hey. I feel like we ended up tapping into a lot more than I expected us to. I was expecting it to be just a little bit, obsession, homoeroticism, it's a good time. But I think that looking at the thematics, there's actually like a lot that you can pull from. I feel like it is sort of like critically and thematically very interesting to look at through that lens. And at the end of the day, they literally wrote each other diaries. I can't get over it.
Yeah.
How about you, Jordan?
I have this as a 4.5 personal. opposite of you. I just really like, I don't know, I'm obsessed with how like campy and like committed to bits these boys are. And it's like, for that, I just thoroughly enjoy it. I don't know. It's like up there in my faves of like the Chris Nolans. And then on the QQ, I'll go a 3 as well.
Cool.
We'll call it like a magic trick. I mean, I just think it's like impossible to like overlook how the magic tricks that they're pulling aren't really necessarily like the most insane magic tricks of all time or anything like that. It's like very clearly like just a trap door and then a double. And so like the audience never really cares, but like the thing that the movie cares about and focuses on is like these two men like trying to impress one another and like their like love between one another. And I mean, I think that it's just like impossible to overlook like the subtext there. And then as we've like explored, like it is a very bisexual somehow. So
it somehow it gets there. Yeah. And
how about you?
How about you?
Yeah, I'm going to have to give this movie, I would say like 4 out of 5 because like I think 1, 2, 3.
Nice.
Yeah. Again, after watching The Illusionist, I think that really like helped like up it. You kind of do realize like it's very easy to kind of fuck up a movie. And to, I think as far as like, I don't think Hans Zimmer scored this, but there's definitely like just the way it's cut, the way it's shot, and there's not a lot of fat on this movie. And
the
I score really
is so good.
Yeah, you really, the tension and like how you're kind of propelled into like the mystery of it, and like they beat you over the head a little bit with the like, are you looking closely? Like, and the whole points about the audience wants to be fooled. It is like a little bit like, guess what? You're the audience, and like you kind of don't want to know the answer just yet. You love the like mystery leading up to it. I'd say like it really only loses a star because it's like the female characters have like no real agency. Or, like, once they do, they're, like, no longer part of the men's lives. And then, yeah, I would go for, like, a 3 in terms of its queerness because, one, of the diary thing. 2, of the just the, like, kind of always circling each other and, like, putting all this money and effort. And just, like, also just the, like, who... Yeah, like, there's no kind of, like, room for queer... Although I can't speak to this. I don't know what, like... queer art there was necessarily in that era, but like they're wearing makeup and wigs and like they're just
they're, like,
very dedicated
about. Yeah,
yeah, they're very dedicated to the art of performance, you know, on stage, but also one of them is performing all the time, which is, you know, a very queer experience when you're hiding a secret. And then, yes. But you know, there's never anything so blatantly, it's all just subtext, so you know, it can't be like a full 5, I guess.
I love that. Yes, I totally agree. And I'm glad that we were able to uncover, like I said, things that I really didn't think we would end up talking about. It's great. All right,
we
Jordan.
We came out of the box.
We did. We are are the transformed
when
men.
When he was like, yeah. What's in the box? It was impossible to not think of like, what's in the box?
From 7? Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Same.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Same.
My friends also pointed out, though, that like the amount of like budget that like Hugh Jackman's character has to have to keep buying like all those fish tanks or like all those tanks like over and
right.
over again, like at some
just
point that's gonna fill up. Yeah, like do you think at any point he's like, has he strategized that like eventually I'm gonna have to start dumping Hugh Jackman like in a river and then so I can refill that tank again?
Right Like how does no one accidentally go backstage or anything and just see one
yeah.
of them? There's
yeah
20 at least.
Very high risk, very low reward.
Exactly.
It's going to catch up with him eventually.
Love of Christian Bale.
Yeah, the reward is the being the better magician, you know? One-upmanship. Yeah. Okay. Jordan?
Yes.
You want to guess the letterbox rating?
And I do.
Feel free to put in a guess for the letterbox rating if you would like.
Oh, I don't know if that would be cheating. I feel like I just saw it or something, but I feel like it's under 4.
Okay. Jordan, you got a guess?
I'll go with 4 on the dot.
4 on the dot?
Yeah. Do you want to lock in a point or no?
I'm going to say 3.6.
Guys, it's a 4.1.
Oh, shit.
Letterboxd loves this fucking movie.
Oh, my God.
There
I would love
so
to know
many
what
5-star
the highest,
ratings.
I mean, like, it's probably The Dark Knight. It's probably his highest rated, I would
his
say, right?
His highest rated?
Or Inception.
Let me see. I think that I can actually sort by average rating, highest first. Done.
Oh, here we go.
It is...
Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight, obviously.
Dark Knight. Right?
The Dark Knight has an average 4.4 on Letterboxd. Oof. That's fucking insane. Oof.
Almost as much as Paddington, but not quite.
Paddington.
Oh. Masterpiece.
Yeah.
No queer subtext in that.
Exactly.
Suplexed The Dark Knight. yeah. So there
and
we go.
That it's, was the prestige.
It was
the
prestige.
Prestige.
We did the pledge, we did the turn, we did the prestige.
Abracadabra.
what a way to go, you know? Abracadabra.
He doesn't even
boom,
like,
dead.
Get through abracadabra. He's like abracadabra.
Yeah,
and then he
like
dies.
He has a little
the
bit
drama.
Ange, thank you so much for coming on our little show. We are so delighted to have you, and this was a great time.
A true delight.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my God. Of course. is there anything that you would like to plug or leave us with your socials?
For now, let's just plug my socials. Again, my name is Angela Farragudo. You can follow me at Magna Farda on Twitter and Instagram. I do kind of like comics and cartoons and stuff, and I've been posting them there. So yeah.
I love your cartoons. Awesome. And I love your Twitter handle.
It's probably the best handle.
Yeah.
Thanks. I locked that real, shit in
real
early.
Niche content.
You committed to the bit.
Yes. I'm glad you got it on Instagram too. I feel like for a while you were like fighting to get the handle or something.
Yeah. Actually, it was like the Magna Farda for a little bit, and I actually got someone to like swap with me for like,
nice. You
gotta have that like cross nice. Branding, you know, the, mm-hmm.
synergy, baby.
And I mean, you would know all about brand synergy and cross promotion. Mm-hmm. So there we go. You can also follow us.
Wait,
what?
Oh, wait, no. Yes, you're right.
You can also follow us mostly on Twitter. I'm at Brooke B. Solomon.
At Jordan H. Gus.
And we are together at Queer Quadrant. You can find this podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast. Rate, review, subscribe, tweet at us, tell us what you think about this movie, about the inherent homoeroticism in writing your rival a year lifelong diary, all that good stuff. All right.
Next week. We've done the prestige.
We have.
We've survived going inside the tub of water. Michael Caine broke us out with an axe. And so going into next week, what are we doing?
Next week, we are actually going into superhero land a little bit. Not in the Nolan camp, but pretty fun. Anyway, we are covering Spider-Man 3.
Bang, bang.
Bang, bang. Lots of finger guns, lots of dancing, and we will have some exciting guests for that as well. So that's what you have to look forward to next week.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
For every great magic trick, consists of three parts of our acts. The first part is called the pledge.
Wait, you're not going to read the whole thing.
Absolutely.